And welcome back. I'm Gary Bautel, and we're going into our second hour of Open Line. The month of September is Army Suicide Prevention Month, and today here in USERA, it's Suicide Prevention Stand Down Day. And we have in our studio to discuss this situation facing the U.S. military and take any questions that you may have, Lieutenant General Mark Hertling, the USERA Commanding General, USERA Command Sergeant Major Dave Davenport, Lieutenant Colonel Graham Bicknell, the Director of Behavioral Health Division at the European Regional Medical Center, and SFC Rodrigue Lemon, who is one of six NCOs in USERA who is Master Resilience Trainer qualified. And I want to give you our numbers once again. In case you want to call us and you have any issues that you'd like to discuss, you can do that. It's DSN 389-4595, DSN 389-4595. The civilian number is 0621-460-85595. If you're outside of Germany, of course, you have to put the prefix on, the country code 0049, and then drop the zero. The email address, openline@afn.dma.mil. You can send in your comments and questions there. And you can also get this information at our PowerView decoder, Channel 7, where the program is also being aired, and at our webpage, afneurope.net. General Hertling, this isn't a pretty special event as a stand-down compared to some of the important stand-downs we've had in the past, but it really emphasizes the need, I think, that we all feel to try in some way to dent this rash of suicides.
Yeah. Well, Gary, first of all, I want to thank you in the start of the second hour for having AFN support the USERA Stand-Down Day. Sergeant Major and I have really placed a lot of emphasis on this, as has the whole Army. I mean, this is an epidemic in our Army. It is of epidemic proportion, even though it's relatively few numbers when you consider the entire population that have committed suicide. It is a problem that is increasing. And what we want to do, part of the effort today is to stamp out suicide completely, zero suicides. And it's because principally the main reason is every single life is important. It's not just important from the standpoint of being a soldier that stands next to you in ranks or a civilian that works in your office space or a family member that's critical, but it's just the fact that from a spiritual perspective, life is important, and we want to get that message across. So USERA is part of the Army in conducting this suicide stand down. It's to address a major issue that our Army is experiencing. And we want to educate today. We want to train today. We want to give the impetus for people to step forward and say, hey, if I need help, and ensure that everyone knows that it's okay to do that. But we also want to train the people who may be asked for help to do the right things when they're asked. So that's the whole focus of today, to reinforce the fact that every life is important, and we have to stand up for life and not allow this this challenge to go unrecognized.
And if I might, sir, in challenging our leaders to get out there and get to know their soldiers, take advantage of the leader discussions at the end of the day, and identifying the high-risk behaviors to get our soldiers help, and to start building that level of trust that's needed to get at this, removing the stigma and this epidemic of suicides.
We talked earlier, Command Sergeant Major, about the programs that are going on today. For those who are joining a little late, what kind of events are expected to happen today at the Suicide Stand-Down?
Well, there's quite a few things going across the USERA footprint, and CG and I got a great brief on everything taking place. Everything from soldiers in the 21st TSC motor pool listening to us live, to very innovative and creative things taking place in the Vicenza community, where they're culminating their day of training with some movies and free bowling to get to community and family activities. To nest it all together.
Standing up for life.
Yeah.
I mean, each community, it's interesting, Gary, each community has kind of put their own little spin on it based on the personalities of their community. And Sergeant Major and I were like, holy smokes, we've got some pretty smart people out there that are addressing the issues that affect them the most. So that's what's been important.
And if I could add, the communities are not just focused on today. It's really how to maintain this momentum, kind of going back to the previous hour. They have a lot of follow-up events planned as well. I think in Vicenza, for example, they're doing horseback riding and really following up with their soldiers with their plan of action that they have made for them.
Colonel McNeil, we were talking about community. A lot of people think that this is all about particular soldiers and their exposure to potential suicide, but the community is really affected as well, isn't it?
It is, and again, I think the resource of today's Stand Down Day, which also has DA civilians participating, is really a demonstration of the investment that leadership puts into it. I mean, it's not business as usual. The whole Army is taking a knee for one day at different times to talk about suicide, to raise it as an issue, to train people to be able to identify each other. And as you point out, that's with our civilian employees also.
SFC Lemon, we talked earlier about your role, and that was quite at the beginning of the program, so I'd kind of like to go over it again. What exactly is you're a master resiliency, resiliency trainer?
Yes, sir. I'm a master resilience trainer. Right now, for the Suicide Stand Down Day, we have probably about 270 MRT level ones who are conducting training on different skills. One of my favorites is avoiding thinking traps. It's a great way for soldiers to combat counterproductive thinking. So that's our role today.
Okay, but that's an ongoing thing as well, isn't it? I mean, when you work with soldiers deploying or coming back, those are one of the elements you talk about, right?
Yes, sir. Yes, sir, it is. We have an actual pre-deployment program, and also we have also post-deployment training as well.
So what do you tell soldiers who are going into Afghanistan, for example, what to watch out for, what not to do?
One of the main things that we talk about is the soldiers being, kind of detached from their family, so to speak. We know that there's still phone calls that can be made. There's still email traffic that can be sent back and forth, but not physically being there as a parent or a husband or a wife or even the extended family's brothers and sisters. That caused a lot of strain on soldiers. So those are some of the things that we talk
about. So resiliency is more of a state of mind kind of thing. You're trying to build up a little... I don't know what to say, like an invisible shield or something.
Well, you better ask Sergeant Major, because he's got an NCO version of this.
Well, exactly right. Thanks, sir. Thanks for the setup. But I often say MRT training is like command maintenance day in the motor pool for yourself and for families and our civilian teammates. Just like we invest that Monday morning of going down to the motor pool and pulling PMCS to make our combat equipment much better, the MRT is a great way of making the individual soldier, family member, or civilian a much more effective team member of our team.
We have a phoned-in question from Lieutenant Colonel White. Where can reserve soldiers in Europe go to find help if they have experienced thoughts of suicide or feeling depressed? Reserve soldiers may not live near military facilities.
Yeah, we have quite a few reserve soldiers in the 7th Civil Support Command who are spread out, and by the way, they do magnificent work because they are spread out all over Europe, and they come together in their drill weekends to take on the civil support functions of civil affairs, training, and medical. But the way I would answer that, Gary, is if you use the online capabilities or if you use the telephone capabilities that are out there, we will get someone to you. If there's a reserve soldier in the middle of Romania that comes back to Germany for their weekends and they're having thoughts of suicide, if they use the online tools, we will get somebody to help them.
I wanted to ask Colonel Bicknell about the types of care that can be, say, provided from the medical facilities we have here, psychiatric care. I know that there are different treatments for different conditions. Could you kind of explain what might be available for people who are, say you've got to go get help and this is the kind of help you need?
Yeah, that's a great question because it really is a full spectrum. You know, it's the full spectrum of including the MRTs, you know, sort of the preventative ways of thinking about things. As General Hertling said, he's a glass half full kind of guy. And it's sort of a positive outlook, very initial, you know, early on in the potential continuum, and then, of course, leadership interacting and building strong social supports across your networks and, you know, continuing to have a strong family kind of thing. Talking to chaplains, they have confidentiality in the sense that what you tell the chaplain is stays with that chaplain, and they cannot be, whatever's burdening you, you can talk to them and know that that will not be shared with anybody. Behavioral health, we have multiple, behavioral health providers are trained in the big treatment modalities for treating PTSD and depression and anxiety. There's also for small cases, the opportunity for medications, those kind of things. Mostly outpatient here in Europe. We do have some intense outpatient programs at Launchstuhl Regional Medical Center, which means that basically they're in treatment all day and then they go to the barracks in the evening and then they're in treatment, which is a very, very successful program, mostly focused on PTSD, but it keeps folks in Europe, keeps them near their families, near their leadership, near their commands for them to be quickly reintegrated back into their unit. For those few that it is a problem that they need more intensive interventions, then they typically evacuate back to the States for in-residential treatment.
Is this something that that is the way you would find out whether a soldier or a family member needed to be actually hospitalized? Is where does the decision factor come in? At what level? Who makes that decision?
Well, that's typically made by a physician in regards to whether they need in-residential treatment. The difficulty is, every case is different. Every person has a different set of stressors, and those stressors may be at different levels, and they may have different impacts on people. So really a good medical evaluation is the key to that decision. And again, our providers are trained to do that specifically. The big part is if somebody is having a very difficult time, on that end of the spectrum, very difficult time, they need to be taken into somebody that can professionally do the evaluation, make the decisions around the protective measures.
So who trains the chaplains and the providers? Who makes them aware of what to look for?
Well, initially, most behavioral health providers get their education in the civilian world, or they go to USHU's, which is the DOD medical school. But the Army also sends us on TDYs to a great number of schools in the States to continue our educational requirements. And we also have great trainers that come in and teach on the latest treatments. So there's the process is, we get our initial training outside the military, but then the military continues that training by bringing in some of the I hate to use the term, but biggest brains from the civilian world.
I know a couple of years ago on a program where we discussed suicide as well, there was an issue about a lack of qualified psychiatrists. Has that been resolved?
Well, we're continuing to resolve that. Glass is half full.
There's the answer is no.
But and it's
it's gotten better, but we still need we still need a few more.
Yes, sir. And it's a broader problem than in the military. It's across the civilian also. So our pool is a small pool of people to pick from, or a relatively small number of professionally trained psychiatrists.
And Gary, what I tell you in talking to Krumbick now that the issue is this, that in the United States, when you have a post like a Fort Bragg or a Fort Campbell and you can centralize, it's relatively easy. Mm-hmm. But given the number of sites we have throughout Europe, it's difficult to get the right kind of behavioral health care specialist at each one of our caserns and posts. So we've tried to do some innovative things, but truthfully, we need more here in Europe than we need at some posts in the United States just because of the spread of our people. But again, if it gets to the point where we really need to have someone see someone, we'll get them to Launstuhl or we'll get them to one of the clinics that have one of those behavioral health.
What about downrange, sir? What about people in Afghanistan?
Yeah, it's the same thing. I mean, there are the behavioral health scientists down there, behavioral health specialists down there. And that's something that the chain of command in that theater has to work for, too.
Mm-hmm. Yes, sir. If I could just point out, on deployment, typically there's about one behavioral health professional per 700 soldiers in the deployment theater.
If I am correct, we have someone on the phone line. Ted from Ansbach has a comment about VA doctors.
Okay.
Ted, can you hear us? Ted? Maybe I was a little too premature to go to Ted.
Yeah, hello.
Oh, hi, Ted.
Hi.
What's your comment?
I just have a comment that I was in the military, and in 2001 I had a TBI right after 9/11. and I had a rough time, and afterwards I seen the Army doctors, and in 2004 I got out on the disability, and I have seen a VA doctor 2 times a week for depression and my TBI, and there's is help out there for veterans if they need help, or for even active duty. There's a VA doctor that will help anybody. And if anyone needs the number or anything, just to let me know, and I will give them the number, and he's willing to help anybody.
Ted, I got to be honest. This is General Hertling. I saw that we had someone that wanted to talk about VA doctors, and I was a little bit concerned. But my experience, too, like yours, has been that the Veterans Affairs has improved significantly, over the last few years. They are still working through some issues. It's good to hear that you've had a positive experience with your doctors, but I got to tell you, since a retired general by the name of Shinseki took over the Veterans Administration, we've seen some unbelievable improvements in the way they're treating their veterans, especially given the number of veterans and the increase in number of veterans since the two wars in Iraq and Afghanistan. So thanks for that comment.
Yes. Okay.
Thank you, Ted. Really appreciate the input. So the numbers again, if you want to be like Ted and call with a comment, especially a positive one, we'll be happy to accept it. His into the studio is DSN 389-4595, 389-4595. Civilian number is 0621-460-85595. That's 0621-460-85595. And if you're outside of Germany, the prefix is 0049, and then you drop the 0 on the 0621. Our email is openline@afn.dma.mil. And you can also get this information in our PowerView decoder, Channel 7. It's also on our webpage, afneurope.net. We have another question which is phoned in. What are the programs available for other services working under Army Command?
I'm just reading that, too, trying to figure out exactly what that means. I think what they may mean is like an Air Force airman or a sailor that might be assigned to a joint command that's part of the Army.
Or like AFN, we have Air Force, or AFN, Navy.
Yeah, exactly. Okay, it's understandable. And what I'll tell you is that the Air Force and the Navy have similar programs. Unfortunately, don't know any of their web pages or their phone numbers, but I will tell you that if you link up with an Army program and you say, hey, I'm in the Air Force and I'd like to get back to my own service, we will help you do that. But the critical piece is it doesn't matter what uniform you're wearing. It doesn't matter if you're wearing a civilian suit or you're a family member at home. If you let people know, we will make sure you get the resources to help you out.
I guess if the Regional Medical Center is involved, the lunch stool is involved, it's open.
Yeah, it's
to
joint.
Yes, of course, and we have providers of Navy providers there and Air Force providers there as well as Army.
Yep.
MilitaryOneSource.org, I see on my screen.
That's
a place to go. We had a discussion a little bit about what you tell. I was going to get back to the resilience trainer here. What you tell folks before they deploy. I kind of want to go back into what you have to do to make them ready to return to the normal life, which is no longer normal for them, because some of them have been through some pretty stressful, even harmful, damaging circumstances. So what's your program when they come back on board?
Well, the post-deployment program, sir, it's mainly to help soldiers to reintegrate with their families and back into their units, back in the garrison environment. It becomes very stressful when you've been away from your family for quite a while and you're dealing with, losing friends during combat, things of those nature. And sometimes soldiers come back and they just feel like nobody understands who I am, or they feel like I should be there. I shouldn't be here.
They have guilt feelings.
Yeah. Yes, sir. Absolutely. So we try to mitigate those thoughts and try to help soldiers to deal with those thoughts. And
isn't this something that's anybody in the panel? I mean, just I know from many of my friends who were in Vietnam that they never really shook off some of these experiences they went through. Is that to be expected with these wars, with these people who come back with those memories?
Yes.
Okay.
Yeah, if I could elaborate, sir. Yeah, that's very true. There's a long history of these kind of responses, and there's no real reason to believe that it would be different. But the thing that I want to highlight from what Sergeant Lemon brought up is sleep disturbance after deployment is a huge issue. But sustained sleep problems can be or are related to some pretty negative outcomes in the sense that, and if you think about it, you know, soldiers that suffer from insomnia basically lay there and they may be thinking over bad experiences that keep them awake, get their heart racing, and lower their ability to be able to sleep, which, and sleep is extremely necessary and restorative to all your cognitive functions. So what I would say is what's emerging from the research is that sleep disturbance can often be an indicator for depression. And depression can also, you know, contribute to suicide. But even just sleep disturbance alone really needs to be evaluated. And again, not necessarily just medications thrown against it, but considerations for therapy to address that those sleep disturbances. Because again, it is so restorative and so important for behavioral health.
Can I put that in soldiers' terms and maybe?
Sorry, sir.
No, I mean,
sorry to make that
up, sir. It was a good explanation from a medical standpoint, but I'll say it from a soldier's term, having multiple deployments, and the sergeant major will back me up. You know, the body, the human body, the human mind, the human soul, is a very, it's a very, I don't know what word I'm looking for, but it is a
awesome.
It is. It's an awesome set of organisms, and it can be thrown off whack by even the simplest things. I mean, you see a football player get hurt on a Saturday and they're down for a couple of months, or you see a baseball player slide wrong into a base and they're going to be out for the season. You put the human body as a soldier or through something that we call combat, and it will affect you no matter what you do in combat. It will affect sleep, which affects the body. It will affect your emotional state. It will affect your mental state. It will affect your social state. It will affect your spiritual state. And we're experiencing that. And then you add to that the other stressors like finances or disciplinary action or previous things that have happened to your life before you've even gone to combat.
Domestic problems.
And you do the same thing with spouses or civilian members, maybe not with the influence of something as traumatic as combat, but everyone has their own tipping point in terms of those kind of things. So, again, it gets to the point that people need help. People need to understand that others care for them, and we in the military do that better than anybody else. I'm convinced of that. When you're a soldier, when you're part of the military family, either as a civilian or a spouse, you go through a lot, but there are those people there who will help you, and that's the criticality of all this, too.
Sir, just one thing to add to that, and this will be very brief. When I was deployed, I was actually in a compound where there were a lot of helicopters. Mm. And once I returned back home, those helicopters were there no more, so it affected how I slept. Mm-hmm. And I know that's very small, but I can imagine what a lot of other soldiers go through with things like
Absolutely.
Losing somebody or whatnot.
Absolutely.
So.
But I think that's a key, Sergeant Lemon, if I could jump in on that,
yes,
is NCOs knowing or leaders knowing their soldiers. It's more than Davenport is showing up late. Why is Davenport showing up late? And I think if you start the process of a discussion, you can tie back to these kind of things. If the soldier doesn't feel like they can step forward, you may pull that from them and get them the help that they need.
The questions and comments, you have about another half an hour if you want to get them to us. We're gonna hang in here until the top of the hour. So again, the number is the DSN 389-4595, civilian number 0621-460-85595. Email is openline@afn.dma.mil. And what we've been discussing so far, I think needs one point needs to be kind of reissued a little bit, because again, I want to get to some of the things we discussed in the first hour. I mean, I'd have all those people hanging with us the whole time. And I asked Command Sergeant Major Davenport about the NCO role. I think that is one of the most important. I mean, I think anyway. The family's important. They need to be. That's very important. They need to be paying attention to the people that are coming back and how they're feeling after being deployed. But the NCO is there with them day to day, working closely with them. That's their role is really significant, isn't it?
Well, sir, I think that's the key element in getting at this problem is leaders knowing their soldiers. If you truly know them and you're committed to their well-being and their families and the civilians on the team, you'll build that trust. And I think when you have that trust, you're more comfortable to step forward and saying something's going on in their life, in their personal life or professional life or any other problems that they're having. May you ask for career advice. I just really think in the bottom of my heart that leaders knowing their soldiers is key to getting at this problem.
Which one of the things I wanted to mention was the SPOT campaign that USERA instituted, the right way and the wrong way. That is so effective, you know. And
the what right looks like. What right looks like.
Because it's the simple situations that happen every day between an NCO and a soldier and dealing with everyday things. But if they're really aware of, you know, how they should do it the correct way, and it goes especially for suicide prevention.
Mm-hmm. It was funny. I was at Garmisch with the chaplains earlier this week, and somebody didn't know I was sitting next to him, and one of the soldiers said, "Oh, that's not what right looks like." And I thought, "Okay, great, we've got the campaign going. At least it's working. This is super."
Oh yeah, it sticks in the brain. Yeah. You remember it very well. We have another question phoned in. How do you encourage families to seek help? Where would you suggest they start? I don't know.
Military one, same thing. Exact same thing. The military one source. And all the same hotlines and emails and if you're talking about the sergeant major was just talking about, hey, talk to your NCO, have the NCO care for each other. You know, the spouses or family members who are away from those kind of support networks, what I'd say is go forward. Seek the members of your family readiness group or your FRISAs and go forward and say, hey, you know, it's been a tough deployment, or I'm having trouble with my marriage, or there's some financial difficulties, or my soldier doesn't understand what's going on. Again, talk to someone who is your peer or someone who you know cares, and they'll get into the system. I mean, I think this day, a reason for this particular day of suicide prevention stand down, will make the emphasis on caring for one another. It doesn't matter if you're wearing the uniform or not, we just got to start caring for each other.
There's one element of you were talking about earlier, not only the awareness walk, but there was I don't remember the term, it was a connection with sort of like a briefing or a leaders talk to their what's that all about?
Well, what we CG specifically asked is being innovative today. Get a move away from the PowerPoint stuff and let's establish a personal relationship with our soldiers and have an open and honest, frank discussion about this problem. But at the end of the day, the wrap-up is that leaders are going to sit down with their soldiers and conduct some type of follow-up. Going back to what right looks like commercial, if you remember, the sergeant not only says he's counseled him and gave him a course of action, but he has a follow-up. So I think that's what we're trying to get from.
In fact, if I could put a plug in, Gary, I have banned PowerPoint presentations for today. So if there's anybody out there listening and they've received a PowerPoint presentation on suicide prevention, please let me know.
Well, we got to give you the numbers once again, because we're going to be taking it right up to the hour, and you can still call or you can still email us. The 389-4595 is the DSN number, 389-4595. The civilian number, 0621-460-85595. And the email is openline@afn.dma.mil. You can check it out on the PowerView Decoder Channel 7 or on our webpage, afneurope.net.
That's a great question popping up on the screen there,
really,
Gary.
Okay, let's see. Well, if he puts it back on the screen, I can read it. Some of the questions on the leader risk reduction tools are tough questions to ask. How do you as a leader really ask those questions, go about asking those questions?
They are extremely tough questions to ask.
Yeah.
But it starts the conversation. And, you know, again, the power of being a soldier, we're asked to do a whole lot tougher things than just have conversations. So what we're really asking leaders to do is is, you know, the phrase today is either man up or woman up or soldier up, and ask the question. You know, you can throw some leadership spin into it and get around it, and I think there's some ways to do that. They are tough questions to ask. One of the questions is, are you thinking of committing suicide? I mean, you don't start the conversation that way. You can kind of work around it a little bit, saying, hey, how's life going? What are the finances like? How's your marriage? You know, da, da, da. And then you finally get to, is it that tough? Are you thinking of hurting yourself? Yeah, that's a tough question to ask. It's an even tougher question to answer. Mm-hmm. But, you know, if you have the relationship as a leader to the lead, you'll get to that. Sergeant Major wrote down on his piece of paper here, it's a tough question to ask, and he said, yeah, combat's tough too.
Yeah. And what about the who asked that question? If we talk about, you know, the NCO, the family member, they notice a problem. I mean, that's even harder for them to ask the question. They haven't necessarily received the right training, and they don't know quite where to go. You can't imagine that if somebody in my shop looked, you know, like he was depressed and wasn't thinking, yeah. I had to walk up to him and say, are you planning on committing suicide? You know, it doesn't seem to, you just maybe.
Or instead you just walk up to him and say, hey, you look troubled today. How's your world?
Yeah.
And then keep drawing the question out. Not so much as a trained NCO or a trained officer, but just as a fellow caring human being. Mm-hmm. You know, that's the only training you really need, is just care about one another.
And being able to listen, I suppose.
Yep.
A lot of folks don't really need much more than that. You know, it's probably just the first step in the process. You can cut it off just by opening up an ear and maybe sitting there for a half an hour, listening to somebody's particular series of problems that they're encountering.
Yeah.
If I could just point out, for the risk assessment, you know, many of these, they are very difficult questions. And I think by calling it a risk assessment, it may make some people go, wait, you know, am I supposed to be risk doing the assessment? But in my mind, when I looked at those questions, I think those are all questions that leaders should know. And many of them they would know without even asking a soldier. So some of the harder questions, I think, really are starting for leaders to a place to start. So a soldier may say, look, I'm not ready to talk about that right now, but it lets that soldier know that the leader's willing to listen, the leader's willing to ask those hard questions.
Yeah.
And then over time, as we continue momentum, we get closer and closer to being able to address those issues. It really, I think Army culturally, this is the first time we've ever done this. I really think where we've mandated soldiers to talk to each other specifically about suicide. And I really think, you know, again, it's not business as usual. This is being taken very seriously. We're making some business changes that will hopefully give people that typically would have been quiet about the problems that they're having the opportunity to see that they can voice those and potentially get to the help that they need, whether that's just unburdening what their problems are and being given encouraging words and that kind of thing, all the way to more medically oriented interventions to keep that soldier safe.
Kumbik, now can I ask you a question?
What, of course, sir.
What is the percentage of the population at any given age group that considers hurting themselves or suicide as a method? Do we know statistics like that?
Sir, I can't answer that question.
Even a guess.
I would say it's probably larger than you would think. Mm-hmm. Suicide ideation, and I don't want to get too technical, but it's suicide ideation is that idea of thinking about it, not taking any actions, no preparations, but actually thinking about it. And I think throughout a person's lifespan, a lot of people have considered it.
Yeah.
A lot of people that may, during teenage life, early adult, when they were faced with a problem, they considered it. And I think the important thing is, if you've considered it or thought about it, think about what stopped you from thinking about it. Was the encouragement of somebody saying, look, you'll get through this. Hang tough. You know, things change. You'll have more control over your life in the future. That you'll grow through this. You'll meet somebody else. Your financial circumstance will change. What was it that made you go beyond that? And I think that's what our folks can tell each other.
That's a great, great point.
The people who are, oftentimes you hear that people use suicide threat to get attention. And that's one reason a lot of people don't take it seriously.
Yeah.
I mean, it does happen.
Yeah, certainly. I think that does not happen as much as we might think it happens.
Okay.
Yeah.
You know, and I think the bottom line to that is, do people use suicide, cries for help, as a manipulative? And there are some that will, but I would say that that's the minority that do, and they still have to be treated very seriously. If that slips through your fingers as a leader, I can tell you it will have a devastating effect on how you think about your leadership and how your soldiers think about you.
Yeah.
If I could, Gary, jump on that, because it's a very important point. There's a series of, and again, I'm not a psychiatrist, that's for sure. I didn't even sleep in a Holiday Inn Express last night. But there's an organization called the Canadian Psychiatric Association, and they just recently put out a policy paper. And they basically claim, and maybe Kronbeck now can comment on this, that there is also the potential for a contagion factor with suicides. And that's unfortunate. And what it means by that is sometimes suicide may be glorified as the way to solve a problem. Let's end it here. Let's do some, let's get rid of our problems just by ending it here. And in fact, there's some debate within the military in terms of some of the things we may be doing, maybe placing too much emphasis on suicide prevention, that tends to contribute to this contagion factor. It's wrong to believe that suicide is unexplainable. It's wrong sometimes, in many of our views, to say that you admire the deceased and you say, well, it's just he or she couldn't overcome the problem. So that's something that I think the professionals are looking at too, and it may help us. Just this conversation today may help us address some of those issues. You want to talk about that?
Yes, sir.
Sorry to put you on the spot with this one.
No problem, sir. I think that is a big thing, that the idea of suicide contagion, that probably everybody sort of thinks about, like at a very general level, that thinks, well, the more we talk about it, the more people who never considered it might think about it. It might become something that they consider. On the other hand, I think that even though people are more talking about it more, people are becoming more sensitive to look for it.
Yeah.
To be able to have the tools to identify somebody that's potentially suicidal. So, as my commander, Colonel Clark, says, it's the sweet and soft, the sweet and sour side of the lollipop.
Yeah.
And action is the important thing, in my mind.
Well, Gary, there's one other point I like to bring out for the discussion. And, we've talked a lot about depression, suicide ideations, et cetera, but it's high-risk behavior. Soldiers that need to get the rush, like Sergeant Lemon was talking about his combat experience, of excessive speeding in their cars. I mean, if leaders are seeing tickets come in at excessive amount of speeds over and over, might be a problem. We have this thing now with train jumping, binge drinking. So
is there a hidden suicide wish in that? Is that just reaction to combat, reaction
no,
being
there,
deployed?
There are indicators in some cases. Those are hidden suicide indicators.
I know we're asking a lot of our leaders, but again, it's just to be have that heightened sense of awareness. I think to reinforce that every soldier's life has value. And family member and our civilians, and ask those tough questions like in the previous email. I know it's hard, but and we're asking them to do a lot of things. But truly, I believe if you take the personal courage, and it's your duty to ask these type of questions and look at behavior as well to make sure our soldiers, families, and civilians are taken care of.
In addition to the issue of the stigma that may be keeping people from getting treatment, I think a lot of people are concerned that if they go and seek help and actually then get it, it goes on their record and their military career might be affected.
I'd like to just make a couple of points about that. One of the, I think, very powerful things about that's going on with the suicide stand down days, and certainly in our area, is there's a number of soldiers that have been willing to not testify, but give testimonials about their own struggles and how it has not negatively impacted their careers. I think that's an incredibly powerful thing to hear. And I would just say I really admire the courage of folks that are able to talk about that comfortably in front of other people, because it will give hope and inspire other people to address their issues and not put those stigmas in the way of seeking help.
Just like the wounded warriors who managed to maintain their military career despite their handicap, if it even is a handicap, because a lot of the technology today makes them able to just carry on.
I think there's there's also Army-wide, there's been a number of initiatives that have really shown that we are changing our perspective. We used to call it mental health. Mm-hmm. The Army Chief of Staff said we're going to call it behavioral health, because for a lot of people it is, it's not a mental problem. It is a behavioral problem that can be modified. Also, for the intelligence or for security, we've changed the security process. You can report whether you've seen behavioral health people or not, or not reported. It's not, it won't stop you from getting your security clearances in the majority of cases.
Well, you know, we got two great examples. One, the SMA of our Army has been very vocal about him seeking help. But I can't think of a better example that how this does not hurt your career than our own commanding general. He's been very open and honest about him stepping forward. And
yeah.
I think that what better way to model the behavior than by our own CG?
Well, you know, it didn't get to the point in my situation. And I'll tell very briefly what happened. During a combat incident, I unfortunately was engaged with the enemy at very close range, and I killed a guy that was just a few feet away from me. And when when he dropped, he had a helmet on, and in the middle of the helmet was a picture of his family, his wife and his three daughters. And I'll never forget that. It was one of those incidents where it you know, killing the enemy is part of the job of being a soldier. But when you personalize it like that and understand that the person you've just killed is the father and the husband, it makes a hell of a lot of difference. A few years after that, and this was, by the way, during Desert Storm, this was not during the recent conflicts when I was a young major. A few years after that, the whole sleep issue started coming up, and my wife was the one that helped me. She said, "Hey, you got to go talk to somebody." You know, I've told this story to some people, not many, but she said, and thanks, by the way, Sergeant Major, embarrassed me on AFN, but she said, "Hey, you got to go get some help. You got to talk to somebody." And it helped significantly. Now, I don't know, you know, I keep hearing this stuff about it goes in your record. I don't know of anybody having access to your record to know about it. So I kind of think this is one of those old spouse's tale that it isn't really true. It's not going to hurt your career. If you're seeking help because, I mean, one of the great things about being a soldier, there's that picture of a good soldier carrying a wounded soldier off the battlefield. That's what we're doing. We're carrying each other. When we need help, somebody else is going to be there to pick us up. That's who we are as an organization. And it doesn't always have to be a leg wound or a sucking chest wound or a bullet to the arm. It can be something that's less obvious, and it could be, you know, you just need help, and somebody else is going to come along and pick you up.
I have a comment here from someone who called in about chaplains. Chaplains are very much involved in this issue. And I think some people are of the impression that, you know, you need to be an active Christian, but that's not the case, is it?
But, yeah, what Sergeant Major said, I mean, chaplains, especially those that are involved in behavioral health, and many people don't know this, but chaplains not only have their spiritual requirements, that they're the spiritual staff officer for a unit, but many of them have additional specialties. Mm-hmm. Some work in hospitals, some work as behavioral health chaplains, but all of them have elements of that. And in fact, just this week I was down at Garmisch where we had the second of two chaplains conferences. And I got to tell you, from my standpoint, the chaplains in USER across the board, and there's about 300 of them, and their chaplains' assistants are the best in the Army. So, I mean, you don't have to be. First of all, we have Jewish chaplains, we have Muslim chaplains, we have I think we have one Buddhist chaplain mm-hmm. in USER too. But you don't have to particularly be addressing a spiritual issue. But as Sergeant Major said, they're trained professionals; they're going to help you out.
And I would point out, as a behavioral health guy, that what the chaplains really bring is being able to look at the meaning of things. What does this mean to me spiritually?
Yeah.
What does this experience mean to me as a person, kind of thing? And that's extremely valuable to help people that are struggling.
We have another question that was phoned in. What are the stats across America with suicide? Is the Army having the same problem? I think there's military has a different kind of situation.
Well, I think what I'll say, maybe Kronbeck, now we talked about that just a minute ago in terms of what are the percentages of people who are contemplating hurting themselves. I think the publicity of the Army's suicide rate has gained the attention of the media because we keep really good records. and we follow up with investigations of, hey, was that an accident or was it a suicide? Did someone hurt themselves purposely or did it just happen? So we have in the Army the 15-6 investigations, the analysis afterwards. The civilian societies don't do that, and often there's more of a stigma as a civilian because families don't want to follow up thinking that their son or daughter committed suicide, so they just, you know, chalk it off for an accident. My personal belief is, and I have no statistics to back this up, is that we are probably a little bit lower than our civilian counterparts in terms of suicide.
I saw some statistics a while back that sort of indicate that, but you're right, there's no real hard and fast numbers
right.
coming out of the United States on suicide in general across the country.
Yep.
The day will be over today, and we will have a lot of activities. Do you do something like an after-action report to see what worked and what you can maybe implement on a more frequent basis or make a regular program?
Well, what Sergeant Major and I have specifically asked our commanders and sergeants majors throughout the force to do is tell us how it went today. Give us some things that you saw, what things were effective in terms of what we trained on and how we addressed this issue, and tell us some things that surprised you. And I think we specifically told them, do not come back to us with a rosy picture. I mean, tell us the good and the bads of today and what we need to do to ensure that this is not just a one-day stand-down, but it's something that really contributes to preventing this trend that we're seeing. Sergeant Major?
Sorry, you hit right on the head. We want to know what's going on in the force so we can make it better for everyone across the USOR team.
We talked about it earlier, but I'd just like, as we are now getting down to the remaining minutes of the program, about 8 minutes, to reinforce the fact that the civilian community is in turmoil in some cases here in Europe because of the transition,
mm-hmm.
and that there is help for them as well. I mean, some are concerned about their jobs. Some don't think that they're getting the proper leadership and help and assistance and awareness of their worries and concerns. But they should be able to take advantage of all of this is what we're talking about.
Mm-hmm. Absolutely, yeah. Okay. I mean, it's interesting because I think we have some great leaders, both on the military side but also the civilian side. I mean, Miss Marin, the MCOM E director, who has a significant resource in terms of linking with the various garrison commanders. One of the best leaders I've seen, one of the best civilian leaders I've seen specifically in my Army career, and she does a wonderful job in terms of taking care of her people and working through the garrison. So, again, it gets back to the point that was asked in the first hour about the Pons Guards. It doesn't matter who you are or what uniform you're wearing. It's just the ability to know you're part of our family. And if you need help and ask for help or someone sees that you require help, we'll do something to help you.
We have another question that's phoned in. Is there a follow-up program for someone who is suicidal? We kind of talked about that. I guess it would depend on what kind of treatment they received. Perhaps Colonel Picknell can...
Yeah, typically, I mean, if there's a soldier or civilian that's committed suicide, they're followed very closely by behavioral health in significant coordination with their commanders. So unit leadership is aware, and that's not to say that confidences are violated or anything like that, but that's to say that the behavioral health providers are expected to give the commanders an update about how's the soldier doing kind of thing. What we found is that it's for across all the behavioral health, it's very important to link the commanders, the provider, and the soldier together because the commanders have a great deal of influence on the soldiers. That's how our system's set up. That's how it's supposed to be. And behavioral health providers or medical providers more generally have specific interventions and have the role of consultation to commanders.
How are individuals handled differently for the ones who attempt suicide and the ones who just threaten suicide?
That's a great question.
Yeah, obviously the ones that attempt suicide, a suicide attempt is an extremely serious event, both in that person's life and that leadership's time in command, those kind of things. There is evidence that if you've attempted suicide, you are much more likely to attempt again and be successful. So those soldiers, they try to look for whatever the underlying reasons are. Is there an underlying medical reason? Is there, you know, a transitional reason or transitional stressor? But I can assure you, if soldiers have attempted suicide, they are in a much higher risk category and followed much more closely.
So there is somebody assigned to them to make sure that you know, that they don't try again. How is that prevented?
Well, it's not
must
a
be difficult because
it is. It's extremely difficult because it's not a static circumstance. It's not a soldier commits attempts suicide and then stays at that extreme high level of crisis throughout. In fact, if a soldier remains suicidal, then they often obviously cannot, you know, contribute as a soldier. Mm-hmm. There's a lot of responsibilities and a lot of authority that we have in regards to, we need to make sure, obviously, people that are suicidal are not close to weapons, not even being thought for deployment, those kind of things. So it really is a crisis assessment. There are soldiers that have attempted suicide, as we said before, that have gone on to become very successful soldiers and leaders. So it is really an individual case-by-case basis.
In the some 4 minutes we have left, gentlemen, I would ask you to sort of sum up your thoughts on this day and what you hope to achieve and what, you know, what you hope to get out of it.
Yes, sir. I think the main thing with today is leaders being transparent to the soldiers. I think it's the big key to this is we all know somebody that may not have attempted suicide, but probably the thought has passed through their head. And it's okay to share that with our soldiers and let them know we all deal with adversity. We all deal with adversity, but we got to be able to bounce back from it. So that's my thoughts on today.
Good.
I would almost say the same thing as Sergeant Lemon. If you're considering suicide or you know somebody that's considering suicide, don't do it. Tell the folks not to do it, that they'll get through it, that you'll get them to help. You're willing to help them and to listen to what the circumstance is. But the most important thing is to get beyond this current crisis and get the help that you need.
Well, as I've been talking quite a bit this morning about is hopefully that everyone listening to us can see that they matter, they have value, and they're important to our team. And I think we're really challenging, to go back to the earlier email, to ask those tough questions to start the discussion that leads to building trust between our soldiers, leaders, and our civilian teammates. And it's more than just knowing the indicators of suicide or depression. But it's about knowing where to take them to get the help, to take that action, to show that we're committed to them, and they're a valuable member of our team.
Yeah, that's great. Hey, Gary, I always like to tell stories, so if you don't mind, I'm going to tell a couple because you've got 2 minutes left. The first one, Sergeant Major and I had the opportunity to go with a bunch of wounded warriors on a bike ride a few weeks ago. And we were talking to a young soldier who unfortunately had a couple of amputations. And he was turning his life around, and this bike ride was the first physical event that he had been able to go through since his war injuries. He came up to both of us after the event, and after 4 days, he said, after 4 days of riding bicycles and understanding that he was a lot stronger than he thought he was, he told the Sergeant Major and I can get through this. That's what I realized today. He said, I was thinking about hurting myself and taking my own life because I didn't think I could overcome these things. He said, and it was all of my brothers and sisters here on this bike ride today that made me realize I could get through this. That's story number one. Story number two happened just yesterday. I happened to have the great pleasure of joining the spouses from the 12th Combat Aviation Brigade at a spouse combat day down in Ansbach, where I really saw a dangerous side of women as they were all getting together and competing. But at the end of the event, this one young spouse came up to me and said that this event, where they were basically playing games and imitating the things that their soldier husbands do, you know, going through obstacle courses and stuff like that, he said, this thing gave me the strength that realized I could get through this even when I thought otherwise. And then finally, the chaplains. The chaplains earlier this week said, hey, we've all got issues out there, but our job is to give one another hope to get through problem areas. Leaders, there are no programs that can replace caring, and we're going to take care of everybody here in USER.
Thank you, sir. On the panel, Lieutenant General Mark Hertling, Commander of U.S. Army Europe, Command Sergeant Major Dave Davenport, USER Command Sergeant Major, SFC Rodrigo Lemon. He is one of the 6 NCOs in USER that is Master Resilience qualified. Lieutenant Colonel Graham Bicknell, Director of the Behavioral Health Division, ERMC. I'm Gary Bautel. Be sure to take advantage of today, your suicide stand down. It's very important you do so. Have a good day.